Good morning. We've got a mild week ahead of us here. Brent Lauck's filling in on the Evan Bray Show. Saskatoon today expecting a high of 10, Regina 8 degrees. We'll certainly take that kind of weather this time of the year. Remembrance Day tomorrow, and with that in mind, I'm joined by Eric Story. Eric is a history professor at Wilfrid Laurier University, and he's found a really interesting story on Canadian military history, I guess we could say. He joins me now to talk about this fascinating bit of history dating back to over 100 years ago now. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Brent. Thanks for having me on the show.
You know, I got to say, before we get into the details here of what we're going to be talking about, I saw that you, even though you live in Ontario, you still have a phone number, 306. Good on you. Staying with Saskatchewan, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah, well, keep that phone number as long as I can. You can take it from my dead cold ass.
This is a really neat story that you have found for us here. We go back to 1923, and two men who survived the First World War, they suffered wounds in that war, and then they decided to do something as far as bringing attention to their situation. Tell us the story here, if you would.
Yes, of course. So the story is of two men who in 1923, after a wager from a fellow veteran, decided to go on a miraculous hike across Canada from Calgary to Ottawa, over 2,000 kilometers. But what's most remarkable about the story is not just the distance they covered, but that both of these men lost their legs during the war. So they did this hike with just one leg each.
Oh, my gosh. And did they make it?
They didn't, unfortunately. They got as far as present-day Thunder Bay, but like I said, still 2,000 kilometers, over 30 kilometers per day on crutches, one leg each. It's just a tremendous story of grit and determination.
Well, and I even think about the countryside in 1923. They didn't have wonderful paved highways to be doing this on, would they?
No, exactly. And that's kind of still something I'm trying to figure out, is what exactly were the roads? What did those roads look like when they were walking across? Certainly not these, you know, beautifully paved double lane highways that we have today.
So at the end of it all, what did they accomplish in your mind?
Well, I think they raised awareness. That was kind of the big push that they wanted to, you know, accomplish on this hike, was to raise awareness of the problems facing disabled veterans in the post-war world. One of the major problems that they faced right after the war is that Canada went into recession, and unemployment went above 10%, and this fell especially hard on people with disabilities, because at the time, disabled people were viewed as inefficient workers and ultimately unproductive members of society. And so as they moved from city to city, town to town on their hike, their goal was to show that men with disabilities or people with disabilities could do things that able-bodied Canadians do with perhaps just a little bit of help. And I think they were able to accomplish that on their trek across Canada.
And so you're saying this started as a wager, basically. A friend of theirs challenged them to this, is how it got started?
Yes, exactly. It was in a local military hospital in Calgary. They re-entered the hospital for treatment of their limbs, and a fellow patient who was there in the patient ward said to the entire ward, "I bet nobody here who doesn't have legs could walk across Canada from here in Calgary to Ottawa." And Hinks and McDougall, they looked at each other, they looked down at their legs, and they basically told that fellow, "You're on."
Did they have any kind of support? What did they use, crutches or canes, or did they have some kind of prosthesis?
They just used crutches. They had prosthetics, and that was another issue that they were raising as they were walking across Canada, was the pain that many veterans were facing with the prosthetic limbs that they were given. But I think probably likely due to just discomfort, it was easier for them to hike on crutches, which, you know, is obviously not easy at all.
Did they have any kind of rules that they made up for how this would play out?
Yeah, there were some rules, and that was actually, those rules were created by the person who initially issued the bet. He said there were two conditions of their journey. One was that it had to be self-financed, And second was that they were not allowed to take any rides by train, by anything else. And so as a result, the two men actually became a two-man traveling troupe on their journey. McDougal played the piano for audiences for entertainment, and afterwards, Hanks would give brief kind of public lectures to raise awareness around disabled veterans. That's how they made their way across.
That's incredible. So they made it from Calgary to Thunder Bay. How long did that take them?
It took them almost 2 months. So McDougal didn't get as far as Hanks did. McDougal got to Kenora, and because of pain, and he just couldn't go on any longer, he decided to call it quits in Kenora. But Hanks, he decided to keep going. When they talked about unemployment, Hanks was actually not just talking in the abstract or about other fellow veterans. He was actually talking about himself, because 3 years before they went on their hike, he lost his job, and he was not able to actually land a job from that time until they went on their hike. And so I think this was kind of a deep sort of personal conviction that he felt he needed to do in pushing himself as far as he could. And so he went a few hundred kilometers farther, but he too called an end to his journey at present day Thunder Bay.
Gosh. And of course, there wouldn't be the media that we have nowadays. I think about, you know, the similar story of Terry Fox and the media attention that helped him get as far as he did and helped him raise the money that he did in his trek as well. So it must have been just a very interesting situation for these two men to find themselves in. There must have been some newspaper coverage or something like that. Would there have been?
Oh, absolutely. And that's how I was able to find their story, was kind of tracking them through the newspapers. I spoke actually to a good friend and colleague of mine, a historian of journalism, and asked him, you know, why do you think these guys' story did not resonate like Terry Fox's did? And he told me it was likely just because of the reality of media at the time in the 1920s. There was no radio, there were no televisions that really amplified human interest stories. And so as a result, Hanks and McDougal's journey, quite unlike Terry Fox's, have largely kind of faded away from history.
I can't imagine what it must have been like for them. Did they carry, I'm thinking, did they have a backpack or something to at least carry food, or did they have a tent, or did they plan on stopping in communities every day?
That was the plan, was to stop in communities every single day. As I said, they, you know, played piano. McDougal played piano, and Hanks gave lectures, and that was how they were able to kind of finance their journey. It was likely how they got fed along the way. But they actually stopped in to speak to a Saskatchewan collection, or Saskatchewan connection, I should say. They ended up stopping in Regina along the way, and there was a fellow war amputee. His name was PJ Brotheridge, and he basically offered up his home to them. And I think that speaks to, it's kind of a certain amount of camaraderie, fellowship among these men. There was a shared understanding and experience of disability that I think Brotheridge felt when he offered his home up to these two men. So that's kind of how they made their way across, was self-finance, but also the charity of kind of good fellows along the way.
Be interesting to know if George Hanks or Marshall McDougall, if any of their families are out there nowadays that would be familiar with their family history. You would think there may be some of them out there.
There definitely is. And after I started digging into the story, I reached out to some of those family members. And I've actually contacted one of them, a great grandniece I'm currently talking to, of Marshall McDougall. And I'm hoping in the coming days that she's going to be able to share some more information about his story. But I also know that George Hanks's relatives are out there, and I know who one of them is. I'm just having trouble tracking him down. So I'm hoping that, you know, buried in, you know, somebody's basement somewhere, that there's some old photos, or buried in someone's memories, there's some wonderful stories that still can be told about Hanks and McDougal, particularly after their journey was over.
Well, good on you for finding the story. This is the first I've heard of this, and I'm guessing a lot of our listeners would be in that same situation. So it's wonderful, you know, 100+ years after that they did this, that it's getting some attention. In the day, did it do anything to help disabled veterans, though, do you think?
Well, I think that these are just small building blocks, right? this is kind of a very early period of disability rights activism. There's not a lot of talk of civil rights, which doesn't come until after the Second World War. But these men provided the building blocks, men like Hinks and McDougall and other members of disability-based veteran groups like the Amputations Association of the Great War, which we know today as the War Amps, and others as well. They laid the foundations for later disability rights activists. And so while their story may have faded away from public memory, they nonetheless have a very important role in sort of laying a platform for those in future generations to fight for disability rights. So I think that's what I would say, is that they were an early generation of disability rights advocates that I hope will be remembered for the contributions they made to Canadian history.
Are disabled veterans today still having to fight for services?
Oh, absolutely. I think I read in a recent study that about a third of all veterans in Canada are finding it difficult making the transition from military to civilian life. Some of them are suffering from operational stress injuries, from PTSD, from moral injuries, and many other forms of disabilities as well. And so I think this story, you know, it's a fascinating and impressive one in the 1920s, but I still think it holds a lot of resonances here in 2025, that work still needs to be done for disabled veterans as they try to reintegrate into civilian society after military service.
Boy, it's just fascinating. Good on you for digging this out and for sharing this story with us about these two amazing men. I was also just thinking here as we wrap up here, Eric, the time of year. I'm guessing they did it in the summertime and not in the wintertime.
Yes, they did. They did it in the early spring, and they were very fortunate to have some beautiful weather. There was very little rain and not a lot of wind as they made their way across the prairie. So,
well, thanks for sharing the story, and continued good luck in perhaps getting even more detail, perhaps, from some of these surviving family members of these two very brave men.
Well, thanks a lot, Brent. It was great talking to you, and hopefully we can chat again soon when I find some more about Hinks and McDougall's ongoing story.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for your time. Eric's story, what a great, great story from Eric, a professor at Wilfrid Laurier University, about these two war amputees who attempted to hike across Canada. Both of them had lost a leg in the First World War. They started out in Calgary, made it as far, the one made it as far as Kenora, Ontario, and the other one continued on to Thunder Bay. They'd originally planned to get, or hoped to get, to Ottawa, but gosh, what an effort over 2 months in the spring of 1923. True heroes, right? Good morning. This is the Evan Bray Show. Brent Laux filling in today on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME.
That's me in the spot.
I was so happy when I got up early this morning filling in on the Evan Bray Show, and it was zero, our temperature. Well, now Saskatoon is sitting at +2 this morning. Regina is -2. We are going above normal today, well above normal. Normal daytime high this time of year runs around zero. So we're going to see a lot of the snow and ice that we received in different parts of the province over the past week or so will disappear. Good news, right? We'll take it as we get deeper and deeper into November. I know the snowmobilers out there are probably shaking their fist at the radio right now. Oh, and also my apologies. I'll get to it here. I'm sorry. I'm just the rookie, okay? I'm just filling in here. Green and white prognostications from Friday. Yes, we had our green and white prognostications on Friday, of course, as we do prior to every Rider football game. And I can tell you right now that it was Bart in Greenwater who got the win. Man, Bart, you should be going to Vegas with this. 24-20 was his prediction with a total score of 44. And of course, it all ended up at 24-21 for the Riders with that total of 45. And Bart, just like that, you are this week's winner on Green and White Prognostications. It'll be happening one more time coming up on Friday as we head towards the Grey Cup. You know, I mentioned Vegas, and maybe Bart should go there with his expertise in sports gambling, if we could call it that. You see what's going on now with Major League Baseball? Gosh, you know, wasn't that long ago there was issues surrounding some NBA players and sports betting, illegal sports betting. Well, now here over the weekend, two players with the Cleveland Guardians, both of them pitchers, both of them on multi-million dollar contracts, And these guys are being investigated now for, well, you know, sports betting. They weren't so much making the bet. What they were doing was they were telling, this is according to the FBI, that these two pitchers, Class A, I think it is, Class A and Ortiz, were given thousands of dollars in bribes. And what it was is these gamblers, well, who knows if they were organized crime or what, but these gamblers had coerced these two into letting them know on a prop bet where you pick an individual action in a game. So these two guys were saying, well, and in this one particular case, the investigation by Major League Baseball says that on June 7th of 2023, one of these pitchers started his outing with a three-run lead and a wide variety of pitches in his arsenal. But sports bettors, the bad guys that he was working with, knew exactly what pitch was coming from the reliever. And this was Emmanuel Class A of the Cleveland Guardians. They bet that it would be a ball and that it would be thrown under 95 miles an hour. He had given them this information ahead of the time. Well, sure enough, his pitch landed in the dirt well outside the strike zone. The bettors involved in this at that time on that prop bet, according to prosecutors, the bettors received $58,000. But they're saying some of these bets that these two were involved with paid out over $400,000. So now these two were being paid off, you know, in the range of $3,000 or $5,000. That's just insane, isn't it? When you think about these professional ball players and the millions of dollars in contracts that they're signed to, and they're throwing it all away now, as this gambling investigation is probably going to see their careers come to an end in Major League Baseball. And that's probably just the tip of the iceberg, right? They say that they even have evidence that one of the pitches that one of these pitchers had told the bad guys that they should bet on, he actually ended up throwing a strike when he meant to throw a ball. And so the bettors in that particular case lost a significant amount of money. And they say that in their investigation, they found a photograph that had been sent to the pitcher from one of these bettors, a photograph of a man hanging himself. And the pitcher responded to that on his phone, showing a sad puppy dog face. But it's probably just the tip of the iceberg, as I'm saying, as they have already issued a federal indictment that was unsealed here over the weekend involving these two people. And they're saying the investigation will perhaps uncover even more. These guys have been charged with fraud conspiracy, wire fraud conspiracy, money laundering conspiracy, and conspiracy to influence sporting contests by bribery. And, you know, maybe it's the world we're living in nowadays, you know, that there is now with the proliferation of gambling and the opportunity to bet. You can't watch a baseball game, a hockey game, or a football game without seeing ads for numerous betting opportunities, which are legal. They're legal, of course, but then maybe that has just inspired some of these people to say, well, everybody's gambling, so what if I give the bad guys some information and they end up getting some money, and I do as well. Yeah, I don't think it's a good look on those particular players, and who knows how this investigation is going to go. Okay, anything on your mind? Love to hear from you today. Brent Laux filling in on the Evan Bray Show. You can reach me on our text line, on our phone line at 1-877-332-TALK, 1-877-332-8255. We've got a wonderful selection of guests still ahead on the program here today. I'm looking forward to our 10:30 feature where we've got Mike Jack joining us. He has 20 world records in the Guinness Book of World Records in the field of chili pepper eating. Does he make a living doing this? That's just one of the guests we got lined up. Still ahead on the Evan Bray Show today. I'm here till 12:30 on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. I'm the fill-in. I'm the temp. Brent Lux on the Evan Bray Show today. We have our Remembrance Day programming tomorrow. Evan will be back in the chair on Wednesday on CKOM Saskatoon, CJME Regina. Right now, I'm happy to spend some time with Ed Stanowski. Ed, former Canadian Armed Forces member, former NHL goalie as well. But Ed brings to us today details on this initiative to better recognize the honorable service of Canadian veterans, especially those from Afghanistan. Ed, welcome to the Evan Bray Show again.
Brett, great to be with you this morning.
So what's this all about, this petition that is to be presented to Parliament?
Well, I would offer that this is a very significant initiative, which is of importance to the federal, provincial governments, or all parties, our Canadian Armed Forces members, veterans, and indeed all citizens of Canada. And what it is there have been some amazing acts of valor in the presence of the enemy, particularly in Afghanistan, and no less than 25 military stars of valor, Star of Military Valor medals, the second highest awards for valor, have been awarded. However, there has not been a Victoria Cross given to a Canadian since 1945. That's a wrong that needs to be corrected and righted. And the organization presence in the or valor in the presence of the enemy, headed up by none other than our former Chief of Defense Staff, Rick Hillier, have put forward this initiative, and it's a petition that will be tabled in the Parliament later this month by Pauline Rochefort. It asks for the Prime Minister to set up a independent board or commission to look at some 25 files where the Star of Military Valor was awarded to Canadian members in overseas in the presence of the enemy. So this is very important. It's something that all Canadians can get behind. Certainly, all crosses all the party lines in a time when things can be fractured between provinces. And I'm very pleased to say that the government of Saskatchewan has very much put and Premier Moe has put his weight behind getting this in front of the Prime Minister so that this board is set up and these files are reviewed.
What's the process now then? If we're looking for the creation of this independent military honors review board, what would it do differently compared to what we have right now?
Well, it's up till now, all of the reviews of the acts of valor were done pretty much within the military itself, within the chain of command of the military. And things were very, very busy during the Afghan War. A lot of the files did go up, and they were looked at that time. There was General Natinchuk during the war, and General Hillier asked for military reviews of this. And they did their job. They looked at it, but things were very, very busy. And there were perhaps some political considerations with regard to awarding the Victoria Cross, again, which has got a very high criteria, a standard that has to be met. But there's no question that the acts of these 25 files need to be reviewed by an independent board with representatives, one might suggest, from all the three federal parties and some other folks that would take a look at these files and say, yep. When the case of Corporal Jesse, one of our own here in the province, Willie McDonald, their actions on the battlefield were absolutely above and beyond and certainly worthy of a close secondhand a look. Corporal La Rochelle and Master Warrant Officer McDonald, their actions, and among others, there's about 25 files that need to be looked at in greater detail.
Why is this important? Why do Canadians need to think about this and get behind this effort?
Well, this is something one might say, and are certainly my opinion and many others, that this is something that can bring Canada together. We haven't had a Victoria Cross awarded since 1945, and yet there have been acts of valor in Korea during peacekeeping missions, other place far-flung places around the world, and certainly in Afghanistan. What was done in the two cases I just mentioned was selfless sacrifice that saved many Canadian lives, and there's no question that they need to be reviewed and looked at, and especially at this time when we're right here at Remembrance Day again, it's something that should resonate with the Prime Minister and his his government in Ottawa, but certainly the people of Canada. And I would offer that if the folks go online and look up petition 6661, the House of Commons, they will be able to sign in support of the petition, which is going to be, again, tabled later this month.
Ed Stanowski, a former Canadian Armed Forces member, a former NHL player, joining us talking about this petition, as he mentioned, petition E6661, which calls for the establishment of this Canadian Independent Military Honours Review Board. I found it interesting, Ed, you were saying there that it hasn't been awarded the Victoria Cross since the Second War, and we were focusing a lot on Afghanistan, but as you mentioned, Korea as well, which makes me think, my gosh, there must have been a number of files, as you mentioned, there's 25, but you think about the Korean conflict and then Afghanistan on top of that. It seems like somebody's been remiss in not making these awards in those cases.
Well, I would say it's been something that's been overlooked. One might even go as far to say it's a wrong that now we have an opportunity to make right. It was really important to the folks that served alongside some of the people in Afghanistan to see what was accomplished, a sacrifice, you know, under extreme cases of danger and the valor that was put forward on the battlefield. In some of the instances, there was loss of Canadian lives, but many lives were saved because of the actions of Corporal La Rochelle and people like Master Warrant Officer McDonald. And again, I could list others, but their actions did so much, and we need as a nation to step up, I believe, and take a look at this. All of our allies who served in the conflict in Afghanistan have all awarded their highest medals. The French did. The Americans had 10 medals of honor. New Zealand, Australia, the British all awarded their highest medal, including Victoria Crosses. It's time for Canada to be proud of what we did, to take a look at the actions of these individuals and right or wrong, in my opinion, and the opinion of others.
Yeah, if we see this established then by Ottawa, and then you look at what's coming in the federal budget as far as increased military spending, will these all be steps that will help improve the morale and the feeling of members of the Canadian Armed Forces about their role in this country?
As a veteran and a former serving member, I would say yes. I would say that the Canadian Armed Forces, there is a great deal of pride. But we need to run it up the flagpole that there's brave young men and women who are doing a job right now. You know, I was at the Regina Pats game yesterday, and there were 15 veterans that I was sitting with and another dozen or so serving members. They all take great pride in what they've done and what they're doing. The serving members, most of them are just returned from Latvia, where they're doing this, the bulwark of with NATO over there in the face of that conflict in the Ukraine. The folks that were veterans that I was sitting with yesterday, they all had tours in Afghanistan and the Balkans. And, you know, it was great to see them recognized at that game yesterday. And, of course, with Remembrance Day, tomorrow, we've got in this whole week of remembrance, there's a lot of things that are going on. And this is just one more thing that I think will highlight and build the pride that we should have and for the most part do have in our Canadian Armed Forces. But we can't be shy about saying and acknowledging the valor that was on the battlefields of Afghanistan. And many of us saw it firsthand.
Absolutely. Are you confident, Ed, that this is going to become a reality?
Well, speaking with Premier Moe and last week and hearing how he stepped up and said this is a no-brainer and we got to make this push this forward, hopefully some of the other premiers will do the same thing and bring it to the attention of the Prime Minister again, and it'll become something of significance and importance to him. And again, I think it's something that's going to bring Canada together. You know, we've got an opportunity to do something that we could all be proud of.
Absolutely. And again, you mentioned if people want to find out more, if they want to sign that petition, if they simply Google petition 6661, that'll take them to where they need to be?
That is correct. And they can get their name on that. Very easy to do. And of course, the other small thing that we're all doing anyway is showcase that poppy on yourself today and tomorrow. And, let the veterans know that, we've got a whole another, a group of veterans. Sadly, there are none left from the Great War, You know, there are very, very, very few of from the Second World War, fewer Korean veterans than every year. But we've got a whole another generation of people who served in Afghanistan and other NATO missions and other and are serving on a NATO mission right now in Poland and in Latvia. And, you know, those are folks that it means a lot to us who have served to see those poppies on Canadian citizens. It truly does pull at your heartstrings.
Well said, Ed. Ed Stanowski, all the best. Thanks for joining us on the Evan Bray Show, and good luck with getting the petition into Parliament and hopefully getting that establishment of a Canadian Independent Military Honours Review Board. Thanks so much, Ed.
Right. Thank you for taking the time and letting me come on and share this.
My pleasure. You're listening to the Evan Bray Show on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME.
Down on the corner, out in the street.
Make sure you got the poppy on today and through the week. Remembrance Day tomorrow, and I'm hoping that you can find some time to get to a Remembrance Day service that may be happening in your community. Take some time to think about those who made the ultimate sacrifice, and for those that are still with us that have helped give us the life that we love so much in this country of ours. One particular item caught my eye recently on Facebook, and it was a photograph from the Swift Current Airport. There is a photograph there that shows one of the old buildings, and then there are a number of white crosses that are there. The Swift Current Airport was one of many of these British air training. It was the British Commonwealth air training plan. And of course, a number of communities in Saskatchewan have remnants of airfields, and some of the infrastructure when these fields were built. Originally, when they started training pilots here in the Second War, there was about 20 existing airports they were able to use, but they built another 80 or so. Kelly Peterson is the guy in charge of operations at the Swift Current Airport, and had an opportunity to talk to him about its history and also about their display for Remembrance Day.
So early days started in 1940, and it served its time here in Swift Current till 1944. It was a Royal Air Force, British Commonwealth training facility.
You know, and a number of these facilities existed. I think there was almost 100 of them, I think, if I read properly, all across the country, set up by the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan, where they brought young men in to learn to fly different types of planes before they would be sent over to Europe to the war. A lot of the places, there's nothing left. It's an open field. What remains in Swift Current at your airport?
We still have the existing three runways that exist here, but there was exactly six of them in a triangular shape. If you go on Google Maps, you can kind of see in the old prairie fields and the crop fields the location of those lines in the field right now. But yeah, there's not much left in the buildings at our location. Brandon has a lot more facilities there, but we do have one last World War II hangar, and it's been totally redone up by the gentleman that owns it.
Anybody have any of the old original planes around there? I'm guessing probably not.
There are lots of bodies out in the back 40 of Saskatchewan and Alberta and Manitoba. Back when they decommissioned these, they sold them off to farmers, and they used them for pulling the wires out for wiring in their houses. They used the metal for different things. Some of the hydraulic fluids were used and stuff like that, and the wheels were made into wagons. So there, we were a decommissioning location, and there was thousands of planes that just got sold off to the people in the area.
That's fascinating. So something that Grandpa might have had that he had pieced together in the workshop on the farm might actually be a piece of one of those World War II planes.
Yeah, there is that. It's been funny. We've gone around to collect a few pieces from people, and it's funny, some of the Quonsets, if you go in there, some of the tin that they had on the roof actually were plane panels and stuff.
Gosh, that's wild. Was it one of the larger ones from what your knowledge is of these British air bases across the country? Was Swift Current one of the more significant ones?
We were a flight training site, so we were probably built the same as the rest of them, but mm-hmm. Moose Jaw was a lot bigger because they were a different facility. So different ones did different training. Some were bomber command sections, some were other flight. Ours, like I said, went down, got decommissioned fairly quick where Moose Jaw stayed active.
So these pilots that came in, and I'm guessing it was British pilots that came in to do the training and that, they must have lived, on base or in Swift Current itself?
No, they were built like a whole new town here. They had everything you wanted from cantina to the bars to the barber shop to the dentistry. On-site theaters, ice rinks were all built on this site. They lived on here, and it was self-contained, basically.
What an amazing piece of history. And, of course, with Remembrance Day coming up, what caught my eye was a photograph on the Facebook page for the Swift Current Airport. I think that's lovely that you have a commemoration, because we think of these young men coming in and learning to fly and going off to the war, but sadly, some of them lost their lives right there in their training, didn't they?
Yeah, we had 17 at this location being pilots and trainers, learning how to fly to go overseas to fight the war, lost their lives just in the basics of training. And these were young men that, were just getting out of high school and stuff like that, or even weren't even finished with high school. They were just wanting to be part of that, and they were sent from overseas. A lot of them didn't even know where they were going. They just showed up in Canada because it was all supposed to be a thing by the Commonwealth as a secretive thing to produce these pilots to get overseas.
That's impressive. Boy, what a fascinating story. And I'm guessing in Swift Current, it's still something that the community looks at and considers a big part of their local history.
Yeah, it's growing a little bit. The museum has put a walking tour out here because our buildings have all been taken away. They've moved to farmlands, or they've just been removed because they were decrepit. But yeah, I kind of appreciate it on site because it's an actual under your thumb, right under your nose location that was participating in the World War.
Pretty cool. That's Kelly Peterson, operations guy for the Swift Current Airport, one of the many airports across the country that were used as training bases for the British Air Command over the course of the Second World War. Again, take a look at that photograph if you got an opportunity. Go to the Swift Current Airport on Facebook. You're listening to The Evan Bray Show. Brent Laux filling in on this Monday on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME.